the monologue.
Seattle can now say, bring us your poor, bring us your tired, bring us your women who want to abort their children, because we are now a sanctuary city for women seeking abortion, which is just this weird and dubious framing of what happened here. Washington State, after overturning Roe v. Wade, will not be impacted at all. It won't be impacted at all. And yet in Seattle, the council and the mayor decided to pursue a bunch of bills, legislation that the mayor just signed into law yesterday about abortion, even though it's not a threat here. We've just waded into this because we wanted to virtue signal our wokeness and our support, not just of pregnant women, but as Bruce Harrell says, pregnant people, which is just so ludicrous.
Now, ultimately, these bills reflect our efforts as a city. They're based on safety. We want every woman and person seeking an abortion to be able to make their decisions to seek reproductive justice with safety. Quite honestly, it's as simple as that, but the work is a little harder to actually implement.
I mean, is it as simple as that? Oh, yes, it is. Yeah, I like how he said pregnant women and people. Are women not people? So what are you referring to? Men? Men can't get pregnant. Now, one of the bills makes abortion, or someone seeking an abortion or having had an abortion, a protected class. So this is the equivalent of a protected class, like being Black, being Asian, being Jewish, being Muslim, being gay.
Council Bill 12037 adds people who have received or are seeking abortions as a protected class, therefore ensuring that their civil rights are protected under our code. Council Bill 120376 creates a misdemeanor charge for people who encroach on individuals seeking abortions or gender-affirming care. Both of those bills were sponsored by council members Morales and Herbold.
So that is concerning, that one, because it makes it sound like they're going to go after anyone who might protest an abortion clinic or a gender-affirming care clinic. And it seems like it's very easy to abuse. We'll see if that actually ends up getting used. It certainly, if it's literally going to get in the way of someone protesting, it would be almost certainly unconstitutional. But is this really what Seattle wants to be known for? I mean, I know that folks on the left love to highlight as many fringe positions as possible, but celebrating abortion is just so over the top to me. And the movement, especially from the left-wingers here in Seattle and bigger cities, big Democrat cities, the movement on what used to be called women's health care, and I know they still talk about it in that way, but it's gone from it should be infrequent but safe, so rare and safe, to shout out your abortion stories. We want abortions on demand and without any apology. And I don't know if that's what any of us should want to be known for. I understand why people are pro-choice. I get it. Or pro-abortion. I don't get pro-choice. I get. And there's a difference between being pro-abortion and being pro-choice. The activists in this city and this legislation is about being pro-abortion. That they are celebrating your abortion, that they want you to come here for an abortion. In fact, they'll even pay for you to get an abortion, which, by the way, is part of this legislation.
And Council Bill 120366 is legislation, and thank you for the council for passing that bill, was part of our supplemental budget where we are appropriating $250,000 to fund expanded access to reproductive health care.
It's not health care for the kid whose life is being terminated. It's not healthcare. And in the vast majority of the cases, it's elective. A woman is choosing, not a person, a woman is choosing to get an abortion. They have the right to do that here in Washington State. I can't get mad that they have a right, because I believe in states' rights on this issue. That's what Roe v. Wade being overturned is all about, giving it up to the states. Now, Attorney General Bob Ferguson today said in a press release for his inevitable gubernatorial campaign that he's pushing back against the Idaho law that almost completely bans abortions. You go ahead and fight on the wrong side of this issue all you want, but the voters are going to remember, and I think history is going to show you on the wrong side of this.
The interview.
In reality, the Inflation Reduction Act doesn't reduce inflation, and the bill itself is really about energy, climate change, as well as health care. So why did they go about it this way? Perhaps it was to purposefully distance the Republicans from policies that they probably agree with when it comes to energy and climate change. Joining me on the line is Quil Robinson. He's the vice president of government affairs over at the American Conservation Coalition. I serve as an advisor, an evergreen advisor with the organization. Quil, welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Good to be here.
There are some aspects to energy policy and climate change in general that Republicans would basically support if they were standalone bills, but it seems like this was always intended to just push Republicans away from the concept that they care about the environment.
Yeah, Jason, I think that there was a real missed opportunity here with this bill. If you break it down and look into some of the climate provisions that were in the Inflation Reduction Act, you'll actually see that there are a lot of policies that Republicans have historically supported and likely would support if it wasn't connected to such a massive spending bill and, you know, with other priorities like healthcare. You know, just a couple of those, like carbon capture, that was in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's something that Republicans have consistently supported. Mm-hmm. Another example is nuclear energy. That's another thing that, separate from this bill, the Democrats likely would have gotten Republican support on. Another example is natural climate solutions. That's something that the Democrats could have worked with the Republicans on, but instead they chose this highly partisan, highly divisive approach of using reconciliation to jam this bill through.
So ultimately, what does that mean that this was a missed opportunity when it comes to action on the environment in general?
Well, you know, climate change can't be solved with one single bill, and, you know, this is only a start. We have to look forward and think about, you know, what are going to be the opportunities to address climate change in the future? And I think that Democrats have potentially alienated Republicans on the other side of the aisle who could be allies on pragmatic climate policy. You know, another thing that I would point out is that while this bill spends a whole ton of money, $369 billion on climate change, the real key here is going to be getting the government out of the way so that this money can actually be deployed. What do I mean by that? There are actually a lot of regulations that the government has that are actually slowing down the deployment of clean energy projects. You may have caught that one of the things that came out of these negotiations with Senator Manchin was this agreement to address permitting reform. Now, that it remains to be seen if they are actually going to be able to carry that through. But in order to actually build these projects, they have to be able to permit them efficiently and actually get them built. And that remains to be seen if that'll actually happen.
Yeah, and if you could dive in a little bit as to what that means, you've got a piece up in The Hill talking about the permitting process and how it's a little bit of a catch-22.
Sure. Well, there's a whole process around permitting large infrastructure projects to make sure that they're not going to have a negative environmental impact. And there's this policy called the National Environmental Policy Act, NEPA for short, that any projects, including clean energy projects, have to pass through. Now, it's good. You know, it's important that there is a review process here. But the fact is, as regulations have been layered upon regulations over the last several decades, it's actually made it incredibly difficult to build even clean energy projects. And just to put a number on this, on average, it takes roughly 4.5 years to go through this NEPA process for major infrastructure projects. Now, if we're talking about climate change as an emergency, as the Democrats like to talk about it, I don't know why we wouldn't be getting the government out of the way and making this process more efficient so that we can actually build these solar farms and wind farms and so on and so forth.
Exactly. So in order to embrace these projects, you have to embrace permitting. But if you embrace the permitting process, you're not really going to be able to embrace fully, at least in a reasonable amount of time, those huge projects. Just bottom line, how would you grade the energy and climate policies from this bill?
It's a mixed bag. You know, there are some things in there like investments in nuclear, like investments in carbon capture, as well as natural climate solutions that I really like and I think are incredibly important and, as I mentioned, have received bipartisan support in the past. And so there are elements of this bill that are really good. But I think that the overall price tag of $369 billion when it comes to the climate provisions and the potential inflationary effect of this bill could really negatively impact future opportunities for climate action, because many Americans are rightfully worried that this is actually going to make our economic situation better. And the Biden administration seems to think that this is the silver bullet to our economic woes and our climate woes, and that's simply not the case.
Saying it. We've been talking with Quil Robinson, Vice President of Government Affairs over at the American Conservation Coalition. Website is acc.eco. Quil, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Now this.
The Monologue.
Okay, we've got two primaries going on today, Alaska and Wyoming. There are some high-profile races. The biggest one is in Wyoming, and we did a little bit of a Jason Tells the Future yesterday. This part is not me being a genius, although that is, of course, the case. Liz Cheney, who's up for re-election, is going to get pummeled. She is going to lose in a humiliating fashion. It will take a literal miracle for her to win based on all of the polling. She decided to focus on her own anti-Trump sentiment and ignored the concerns of her constituents, which are overwhelmingly pro-Trump. I think he won 70% of the vote in Wyoming. Wyoming deeply supports Donald Trump. And so for their one congresswoman to come out and just go on a crusade against him, it was just too much for them. So they're going to go with her challenger. Her name is Harriet Hageman. She is not just an attorney, but she is a Trump-backed candidate. And that's very clearly going to lead to her just absolutely pummeling Liz Cheney. The media is going to pretend in the most insufferable way possible that we just lost the last hero standing up for what's right. The last person who was standing in the way of fascism for the Republican Party. And Liz Cheney, and don't worry, she's going to run for president because the Never Trumper groups that Washington Post today or yesterday pretended have a lot of influence, even though they keep losing all their elections, that she's going to run to protect the country from Donald Trump if he runs again. It's going to go nowhere. Now, the only two other races that we want to pay attention to are happening in Alaska. And yeah, sure, there are other important races, but these are the ones that the national media outlets are paying attention to. Number one, they're looking at the Senate race. Lisa Murkowski, who I believe has voted in this term so far in the last 2 years, 79% of the time with Biden approved agenda items. She is up for re-election. She's going up against a very large crowd. And you would think, because she is very much more of a moderate Republican. She's a Republican. I'm not going to pretend otherwise, but she's more moderate. She's a little bit too bipartisan, where she starts to throw some very key principles that we have as conservatives under the bus in order to be, quote unquote, bipartisan. She is up against the Trump-endorsed Kelly Schiavacca. Now, Kelly Schiavacca, if this were a traditional primary, she would be the clear winner and Lisa Murkowski would be the clear loser. However, Alaska has ranked voting, which means you get to vote who is your favorite candidate, your number one pick, and then you go to number two, and then three, and then four. They're allowing the top four candidates for Senate to move forward. This is a process in ranking that helps Lisa Murkowski, because she's obviously going to be in the top four. But let's say she's number four, right? And let's say Schiavacca is number one. Well, once she goes to the primary, you've got four people running. Same thing. You get to vote for your top four in that case. All the Democrats are going to vote for the Democrat. And then their number two choice, they'll likely pick Lisa Murkowski. Now, some Democrats, by the way, will go for Lisa Murkowski. But if this was just Republican versus Democrat, winner take all in advance of the general, Murkowski would be in trouble, or at least it would be a competitive race. But because that isn't the case, the rules now are in her favor. The rules, however, are not in the favor of Sarah Palin. She is running for the congressional seat that was left open by Don Young. He died in March. She decided to run. Now, they have in the special election, as well as the general, she's technically running for two races right now, but we expect both races to be identical. What she's doing here is also running in the ranked voter system. And she's running up against a Republican, Begich is his name, but also a Democrat. The problem is, for her, she is very polarizing. So I imagine that there will be a lot of Republicans who will go with Begich and put Sarah Palin second. But there are also Democrats who will vote with the Democrat candidate and probably put Begich second instead of Palin second, which puts her at a little bit of a disadvantage. It is a confusing and convoluted way. I hate the ranked voting system. It gives a leg up to the wrong kinds of people. And by the way, this comes from the same folks who on the left who claim that the Electoral College is wrong. So they want to come up with ranked voting for a reason. It helps their candidates, and it hurts the candidates that they don't like. So we'll end up seeing what happens later tonight at, I think, just in the next 40 minutes, 45 minutes. That's 6 o'clock is when Wyoming closes. I can't remember off the top of my head when Alaska closes. I'll have some of the coverage up on my Twitter feed once we get those results.
The interview.
There is a coalition of charter schools out in Michigan and Ohio that are getting together for a federal lawsuit. It's challenging the Department of Education's rule that would punish successful charter schools nationwide. So there is a Washington connection. Joining me on the line from the Pacific Legal Foundation is attorney Caleb Pruckenberg. Caleb, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So take us through what this case actually entails.
So Congress set up what they call the Charter School Program, which is a grant program that every year sets aside hundreds of millions of dollars a year to expand access to charter schools, public schools that don't fall within the traditional, normal public school model. And Congress set up very clear criteria, and they say our main goal here is to have more schools. Unfortunately, the Department of Education in this administration is really hostile to charter schools in general, and they issued a rule basically making it a lot harder for the most successful, the best charter schools to access this funding.
So what is that actual rule that's making it difficult for them?
So there's a few aspects of the rule, but basically they set up additional priorities and requirements for grant applicants. And some of them seem pretty innocuous, but are actually targeted at good schools. So one, for example, is an applicant has to demonstrate the need for the project. But the way the Department of Education looks at need, they look to school enrollment numbers in a traditional public school. And if the school isn't overcrowded, if it's not completely full, they've decided there's no need for a charter. Even though anybody who knows anything about charter schools knows they're supposed to be an alternative
exactly.
to an academically failing program.
Well, so what it sounds like then, and this does make sense from the perspective of the political implications here, is they just don't want to compete with public schools, right? I mean, this has union influence all over it.
Well, unfortunately, I think that's the case. I mean, there's another new criteria in the rule that says that a charter school has to get a commitment to cooperate with the new project from the public school. But that's a way that a public school that's hostile to the whole idea of charter schools can veto the project.
Yeah, and it kind of feels, can you name a single public school out there that's all like, oh, yes, we love these charter schools. Please, we want more of them.
Right. And I think that's what the administration has, they've really sided with the public schools, the teachers' unions, who are hostile to this whole idea because they resent the competition.
Mm-hmm.
When that's the wrong way to look at this. I mean, these are supposed to be innovative programs that show what could be possible. And hopefully it improves all schools. But unfortunately, I think a lot of districts see it the other way. They really resent these programs.
They do. And obviously there are, for the most part, we're talking about schools that get its funding based on enrollment. And if students leave to go to a charter school, there is financial cost to be paid by these traditional public schools. But again, the only reason for the most part that parents are pulling their kids from public schools and going into charter or private or homeschooling is because, frankly, they're upset with the direction of their public school. You would think that they would take this as a wake-up call to say, hey, maybe we should turn things around and, ditch all the woke nonsense and just teach the basics. But for some reason, they don't. So what's the legal argument as to why this is unconstitutional or it's illegal?
Well, the Congress, when it set aside this money, was really clear. It said this money should go to schools that are high-achieving charter programs. They have criteria in place. That's it. Congress did not give any role for the Department of Education to say, oh, we're going to have additional criteria. We're going to have these extra steps. And so just as a very broad matter, the Department of Education doesn't have any role here.
Yeah.
And they certainly don't have the authority to issue a new rule that makes it much, much harder for charter schools that serve urban areas, that do really good jobs for disadvantaged kids. The department doesn't have a job here to say, no, we don't want to give the money to those programs.
Yeah, and obviously, even though this is a case that's based upon schools in Michigan and Ohio, this has national implications. So obviously, we're wishing you the best of luck in defense of charter schools. We've been talking with Caleb Kruckenberg. He's an attorney over at the Pacific Legal Foundation. The website, pacificlegal.org, pacificlegal.org, wonderful organization. Caleb, thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Now this.
The Jason Rantz Show.
Jason Rantz has followed that in detail. He's a radio host in Seattle. He broke this story. He joins us now.
Never shy of his opinion, Jason. Definitely letting you know how he feels about that.
Wow. You laid that down.
Long Form, presented by Northgate Rare Coins and Precious Metals.
Snohomish County, unfortunately, is getting on the bandwagon of just purchasing a bunch of hotels with the intent of housing the homeless. Unfortunately, it mirrors what's going on in King County and other Democrat-run cities and counties where there isn't really a program in place or a set of rules for the homeless. But my next guest is hoping that they can at least establish some for the addicts. Joining me on the line is Snohomish County Councilmember Nate Nehring. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, Jason. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
So it looks like it's a done deal. The hotel is going to be purchased and they're going to use it for the homeless. But what would your proposal be?
Yeah, so I think it is a done deal. You know, you had a press release come out with all three Democrats signing on in support. So, indicates that they have the support they need to pass it. So, you know, essentially what that proposal does is it will purchase hotels and convert them into county road, bridge, and permanent housing units, similar to what King County does. And, you know, I'm all for providing services for those who are in need, but these are taxpayer dollars that we're talking about. And so, to me, that means that there needs to be some accountability involved. And so, what I did is introduce an ordinance which says that anyone with a drug addiction who stays at a county-owned hotel would be required to participate in a drug treatment program.
Why?
Well, I think it's important, you know, when you talk about the individuals that we're dealing with, we've got lots of services for people who want to voluntarily take on treatment, but there's a large portion of the population, you know, from ride-alongs I've gone on talking to police and social workers who are refusing treatment and who want to, stay on the streets and who are battling that addiction. And so we've got very few tools as local government, thanks in part to the state's Blake decision to address that population and to get them into treatment. So I think this is one way where we can really use some of the tools we have to incentivize people to get treatment. If we say, look, we've got these housing units available, but we're only going to allow you to come into the units if you agree to participate in a treatment program.
The argument is that by instituting these rules and other rules, that it means some folks just simply won't go into the housing. They'll stay out on the streets and they will inevitably die there. So what's your response to that?
Well, I think the problem is if the way that I think the progressive side is looking at it is let's just get people off the street and into shelter. And for me, if somebody's going to overdose on heroin or if they're using fentanyl, I don't know that it makes much a difference if we're going to bring them into a hotel room to die as opposed to overdosing on the street.
Exactly.
I think the key that we need to get at is getting at the root of the underlying problem, which is the addiction, right? Just housing somebody is not going to solve that. And so I don't see it as compassionate to just say, well, let's put a roof over their head and let them continue to suffer and die in misery. I think we need to address the root of the problem and say, no, we are going to, you know, get you into treatment one way or another, whether it's voluntary or whether we need to motivate you. You know, this way, or in some cases, what we were able to do pre-Blake was say, you know, you're either going to take treatment or you're going to take jail. And so I think we have to have those sorts of things for that portion of the population, which is just adamantly refusing treatment voluntarily.
When we've seen that approach work in cities like Marysville, the mayor is your father, he had that carrot and stick approach and was getting some really good results.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, I had the chance to go on some of the ride-alongs with those embedded social workers and police officers and actually got to see that work and talk with recovered addicts who had built their lives back and were in a good spot, you know, reunited with family and in a job. And I'll tell you what, Jason, the thing I find, you know, really, really interesting is everyone I talk to who's a recovered addict or who's a family member of a recovered addict has said, we have to use tough love. You can't just coddle people and you have to get them into treatment. You have to really give them, a choice where they have to take the choice. They can't just be left to continue using and, you know, they'll just never come around, some of these people, on their own if you just leave that open to them. Yeah. So I think it's important as government, if we're going to use taxpayer dollars and open up housing units, that's great. But we've got to have that string attached where we say you've got to participate in treatment if you have a drug addiction.
Snohomish County Councilmember Nate Nehring joining me on the line. He is proposing a simple plan that would say, hey, if you're going to live in any of the homeless hotels in Snohomish County and you're an addict, you have to participate in a program to treat that addiction. We're not just going to allow you to get a free room. And, you know, you point to taxpayer dollars. In this case, you know, at least to start, the taxpayer dollars are from, you know, people living in Kansas, people living in Wyoming. This is being used from COVID funds.
Federal, yeah.
Yeah, the federal laws. But the fact of the matter is, you have to pay for these hotels every single year afterwards. And in this case, right now, we're talking about two hotels, one in Edmonds, one in Everett, I think 165 beds or so between the two. So how do we have any idea of how expensive it's going to be after, you know, we just pay for the hotels with the American Rescue Act funds?
No, I don't. So you make a good point. So we have the capital expense, which is the federal COVID funds are being used for. But then we're going to have annual ongoing expenses, right? And I believe what's going to be used to pay for that is our recent sales tax that passed, the 1590 funds for subsidized housing. And that was passed in November. And I remember you covered that, which I appreciated. But I think that's what's going to be used to cover this into the future. And those are local dollars, right, coming out of your sales tax in Snohomish County.
And folks really don't have any idea how expensive this is going to be. I know that they probably have some ideas of projections, but when you are not requiring someone to get the treatment for the underlying cause of their homelessness, you can be guaranteed that, number one, the costs are going to accelerate, and number two, especially if we're talking about more than just bridge housing, because if they're turning this into permanent hotels for these folks, which is what I think ultimately will happen across the board, you've just created the state where you've adopted an addict and you're not requiring them to do anything. So you're just going to pay for them all the time, 24/7. And that just seems to be the wrong move.
Right. Well, I totally agree. And, you know, what's interesting to me too, Jason, is you don't have to look too far to see in a city where this is failing, right? In Seattle and King County, they're taking this model. They put over $1 billion annually into these housing. And what happens? Their homelessness gets worse, drug abuse gets worse, crime gets worse. And so I think this harm reduction housing first model has proven to be a failure. And I think we need to take a different approach. And one way to do that is to say, yeah, you know, we've got the housing available, but it needs to be all encompassing. You have to take the treatment. And then, you know, let's get you into housing. Let's get you into job training and get you all the way back on your feet to where you can be healthy again and be a contributing member of society. And I think that's, you know, best for the individual, that's most compassionate for them, but it's best for the public as well.
Well, and that's the difference between the conservative approach and the progressive approach. Progressives just want free housing and no judgment of one's addiction because it's stigmatizing. But folks on our side say, I'll stigmatize people if it means they're going to get the help that they need and don't die from an overdose. If the negative thing about this is that they get stigmatized for a few months, but then they get the help that they need in order to survive on their own, okay, I'll stigmatize all day. I am totally okay with that.
Exactly. I'd much rather improve the chances that they survive and get clean than, you know, put a house over their head or a roof over their head, but, you know, they still have just the same chance of overdosing.
How concerned are you that this is going to accelerate, that you're going to have another month or two, another hotel that's going to be purchased, and all of a sudden, again, the shift in language is, well, we're not going to do bridge housing, this is permanent housing. How much concern do you have about that?
Yeah, I mean, even already, you know, we it was one at first, and now it's two. And so, you know, I think you're certainly right. We could see more of these come up. For me, you know, what we should do, and this goes for any government proposal on anything, is we should look and see if something works. And if it doesn't, we need to repeal it, right, or take it back. And so I think, you know, this obviously looks like it's going to pass. But if, you know, a year or two from now, we see that it's not getting the intended results, obviously, I think we should go in the other direction and not continue doing this. I plan to vote no anyway, unless we include this drug treatment requirement.
And
but I
imagine
would hope even those who vote yes would.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. I imagine Sam Lowe is going to join you in that, your other conservative council member. You know, Snohomish County is a purple district. Obviously, there are more areas like the ones you represent, Sam represents, that are more red than Everett. But a lot of folks always say, I've left Seattle, I've left King County because I didn't want any of the nonsense like we find there. And then all of a sudden you wake up and you see a proposal that's a done deal. It's been debated and discussed behind closed doors by the Democrat control on the council. And bam, you've got now King County policies, bad policies, spreading to Snohomish County.
Exactly. And, you know, I think this harm reduction stuff and, you know, things like not wanting to require drug treatment, I don't think that's mainstream even among Democrats. I think it's a very, you know, it comes from progressive activists. I've heard from Democrats who say, yeah, I think this is a common sense proposal. And so I think that's what happens when, you know, when you have activists influencing policy as opposed to, you know, taking the general population and seeing where they're at on these sorts of things.
Well, it's a shame what's going on in Snohomish County. Your idea is a very good one. I hope that people listening right now step up and demand that their council representatives on the county council support it. I'm not going to hold my breath because I know how Democrats there act. However, it's important to step up, folks. We've seen significant wins when you're able to actually organize and be civil about it. And I think this is a really good opportunity to do that. Snohomish County Councilmember Nate Nehring, thank you so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Jason.
Of course. Now this.
The Jason Rant Show.
Let's bring in our man in the Pacific Northwest, KTTH, Seattle top radio host Jason Rants.
Great to have you with us to tell people a little bit more about this.
Jason Rants is in focus now.
Jason Rants, thank you for your reporting on that.
The quick hit.
So there are a few political tidbits that I thought we would jump into with the limited time that we have for the quick hit. The first one is actually some really good news out of Seattle. And when we're talking about political news, we usually don't frame it as good news. But in this case, there's some considerable good news in that a very divisive politician, a very divisive activist, is saying goodbye to Seattle. Nikita Oliver, the twice failed candidate for the first time mayor and then the second time council, she is ditching the city of Seattle. She's taking a job in Detroit. Now, I was going to say that, hey, let's find out what city she's going to try to destroy next. Going to Detroit? It's already kind of a city that's starting from behind. Now, she obviously could make it work. Or work. She can make it worse. She definitely can't make Detroit work. She can make it worse. And if you're Detroit and you're living there, I would be so upset that she's taking a job there. She's working with the Detroit Justice Center. And it's a nonprofit law firm. She's a lawyer. She's not a very good one. And according to their website, it's a law firm that quotes, that will be working alongside communities to create economic opportunities, transform the justice system, and promote equitable and just cities. So it's another left-wing nonprofit. They say, Nikita works at the intersection of arts, law education, and community organizing, striving to create experiences which draw us closer to our humanity and invite us to imagine what we hope to see in the future. Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, good luck with that if you think you're actually going to get that from Nikita Oliver. This is one of the leading proponents for the defund movement, defunding police, abolishing prisons. She is one of the reasons why we have the crime problem that we have, because she was with an organization here, Creative Justice, that was part of the criminal industrial complex. Let's just say it like it is. Because these are some of the organizations that end up getting the criminals who are part of diversion programs. Instead of actually going to jail, they end up getting diverted to programs like Creative Justice. The problem is they don't really care about the community as much as they pretend to. They are pro-criminal, in my view. They're not pro-justice. They don't care about justice. They believe that the criminal justice system is inherently racist. Thus, they treat the criminals as if they're the actual victims. And they do it around the framing of, oh, we just want to get people's lives back in order. These are people who have had traumatic lives and experiences, and we can get them back on the right path. But they're not very good at it. They don't have a great track record. And you know they don't have a great track record because they never celebrate it in any meaningful way. Same thing with like the homeless industrial complex. Oh, our program is going to be great. Okay, what are some of the successes? What's the successes of the homeless hotels we just talked about with Nate Nehring? How come we don't hear any success stories about the tiny home villages? Because they very rarely exist. So no more Nikita Oliver for Seattle. None of that is bad news. All of this is great news. It should be celebrated and sung from the mountaintops. I mean, you don't have to sing it because that's a little weird. Another political news at the national level is not news at all, but we're going to pretend it is because it makes a point for us. And frankly, it's being treated as news. Jill Biden, the first lady, Dr. Jill Biden, she's a doctor if you didn't know. She now tests positive for COVID-19. She's apparently experiencing mild symptoms. The fact that she didn't catch COVID sooner is, you know, one of the mysteries of Omicron. She's obviously she was in contact, close contact with the president before he tested positive. You would think that she would have caught it from him. This is a very virulent strain, even though it's mild, it's virulent. It's easily caught. So you would think that she would have gotten it sooner. And it's certainly possible that just the testing had her as negative and she was asymptomatic. But we're told that she was negative yesterday during her regular testing routine, but then she began to develop cold-like symptoms late in the evening, so it came pretty quickly. She was tested again, or as Como TV writes, texted again, and the test came back positive. So she's doing fine. You know why we know that? Because even without a statement, we can assume she's doing fine because she is otherwise healthy, and this is a mild virus. This is the equivalent of getting the flu at this point for even older people, not the immunocompromised folks. They still, and by the way, I'll say this, probably also treated the same way as a cold for the immunocompromised, meaning you can die from the flu. My father died from the flu. It's obviously possible, and it depends on your personal health. But when the CDC comes out and basically says we're going to treat unvaccinated the same as the vaccinated, it's telling you that the COVID virus is now just like the flu virus. That's how we should be treating it. Now, I know a lot of people don't want to treat it that way because they love the power that came along with COVID. They love that control over your life. They love dictating what medical care you're going to get. We're going to force you into a vaccine just because. And really, it's because not even necessarily just the power. They know that the people who are less likely to get the COVID vaccine are conservative, and this was their way of purging conservatives from society as best as they could. You no longer get that job. But we need to stop pretending. Stop pretending that anytime someone now gets COVID, it's a news story. In fact,
the last rant.
I will say this for my last rant. All of us need to stop pretending that this is news. When we stop pretending this kind of stuff is news, it ceases to be news. Now, there will always be little kicker stories here and there that aren't really news stories, but the media will start picking up on this. You know what we've heard a lot less of in the media? A lot less coverage on COVID cases. We still have COVID cases. We still have COVID deaths nationally. They're not covering it the same way. Why do you think that is? Because the audience, the public said, yeah, we're done. We're over it. And so CNN no longer has, even though they said every lost life was a tragedy and we are going to be here every step of the way. They don't have that little lost life calendar anymore or Chiron anymore. They don't do that anymore. Why is that? I thought you cared about every single life. They might still care, but they know that you have moved on from coverage of COVID. And so they're barely covering it anymore. Barely covering it. The virus didn't go away, and they're barely covering it. You guys did that. Thank you, by the way, for doing that, because I was getting sick and tired of talking about COVID so much. So when we stop treating this, don't send out tweets of like, oh, I hope she'll be okay. We know you hope she'll be okay. My default for you is hoping that people will be okay if they get COVID or the flu or stomachache. This is not news. If she's severely sick, then it's news. But by treating simply getting COVID as news in a way that we wouldn't if she had a stomach ache, if she had a headache, if she had the flu or a cold, you are turning COVID again back into something it's not. So I'm going to treat it like it is. It's kind of just there. You're going to get it. We'll all get it at some point and we'll mostly be okay the same way that we would treat it as if we got the flu. And that's the last rants.